This is Fair Examination on the Mormon Faircast. Fair Examination takes a close look at interesting and sometimes difficult issues facing The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its members.
My name is Greg Smith, and I'm your host tonight. We have a special guest with us, Dr. Brian C. Hales. Dr. Hales is a board-certified anesthesiologist in Layton, Utah, and he graduated from Utah State University and the University of Utah. He's probably better known in Latter-day Saints circles for his work in Mormon history. He's just published his 7th, 8th, and 9th books. He's written extensively about the Mormon fundamentalist movement and has authored award-winning books and articles about that. He's also published in a variety of journals such as the Mormon Historical Studies, Dialogue, and the Journal of Mormon History. He also contributed a chapter to The Persistence of Polygamy, Newell Bringhurst and Craig Foster's three-volume series on LDS plural marriage. He has recently published his three-volume series on Joseph Smith's polygamy. Volume 1 and 2 are subtitled History, and Volume 3 is subtitled Theology. When we found out that we'd have the opportunity to interview Brother Hales, I said, well, make sure you get someone who's read a little bit about plural marriage so they can ask him some good questions. That was maybe not a smart thing to say because I got nominated to be the one to ask him the questions. So you and Dr. Hales are stuck with me tonight. But it's a real pleasure for me to talk to him, and I look forward to exchanging some ideas with him. Brian, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. And let me say, I know your research on this topic, and it is substantial. So I appreciate you taking the time. And I should also mention to the audience that you helped me with several sections of the book. So you're acknowledged in there. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure. I didn't do much, but it was nice to help out. So I've got some questions here, and we'll just kind of see how this goes. We're going to try to keep it relatively – I'm not going to assume that our listeners know anything about plural marriage. I got cautioned very careful. They said, don't you and Brian go herring off into the esoteric areas and leave everyone lost. So I have a couple questions that I want to ask you, but I'll flag those so everybody knows that I'm maybe getting into stuff that might interest me but may not interest everyone. For the first, in the first place, how long have you been studying plural marriage in an LDS context?
I had a member of my family who joined the All Red Polygamy Group back in 1989. And to be honest, I prayed the prayer, if this is true, then please show me that it is. And I'll be honest with you, Greg, I was never comfortable with their claims to authority. And you could read in the Doctrine and Covenants that there's one man who controls it. And I was never convinced that the authority was outside of the church and the line of authority that they claimed were at all true. And so anyway, I've been looking at fundamentalist polygamy since 89. And then just in the mid, maybe 10 years ago, people would ask me questions about fundamentalism. And then they'd ask me questions about Joseph Smith. It was split about 50-50. And the questions about Joseph I couldn't answer. And that's when this project started.
Okay. So it sounds like you really kind of approached this study almost in reverse historical order. You started with the fundamentalists, which, you know, didn't really get going until about the 30s, I think, the 1930s, and then kind of went back in time to Joseph. Were there advantages or disadvantages looking back to approaching it in that way?
Well, I don't know that I would say that there really was, other than the fact that people were asking me questions about Joseph Smith and particularly like polyandry, and I just didn't have the answers for them. So I have made the statement that in looking at Mormon fundamentalism, I find a lot of men who consider themselves to be prophets, but I consider them not to be true prophets. But then I studied Joseph Smith, who I believe was a true prophet, and that is just a lot better. So.
Okay, that's an interesting perspective. We'll probably come swing back to that idea. So I noticed in the book that an LDS researcher, Don Bradley, is listed as having provided assistance. You know, he's almost a bit of a co-author in a sense. So can you tell us a little bit about his role in putting this all together? Because, I mean, for our readers may not have seen him, but, I mean, these are massive books. They're each, what, at least 600 pages, the two first ones, and the last one's probably about 300 or 400. So what was his role in all this?
The books couldn't have been done without Don Bradley's help, and he had done some research for me for a book that I'd written in the early 1990s on fundamentalism, and I was able to employ him for a couple of years. And as we got into it about a year, it dawned on me that if I were to continue to employ him, and I've invested probably $50,000 of my own money on this whole project, and he received the bulk of that. But it dawned on me that if we continued, we could probably get every known document dealing with this topic in the books, either referenced or preferably a transcript of whatever the document was, if it was important. And then nobody in the future would be able to pick and choose certain evidences and ignore other ones and portray Joseph in a negative or excessively positive light. So we had Don Bradley employed for a couple of years, and he went back to Yale to the Michael Quinn collection, which is remarkable. A couple of times he was all up and down the Wasatch Front and got a lot of help from the people at the Church History Library. In fact, he talks about being in there one day and hearing the still small voice of Robin Jensen saying, "Don, you should check out this new file that we've just cataloged." Turns out it was the Andrew Jensen papers, which is arguably one of the most important collections, certainly in the top three or four of documents dealing with this topic that we know of currently. Wow. And I just would add that at the time Don was doing this, he was not a member of the church. He had had an atheist period a few years before, and I didn't know that. I just knew he was a great researcher and that his hair was way out there, but I never asked him about his hair. But anyway, 6 months after we had finished our work together, he called me on the phone and said, "Brian, I have just been rebaptized." And so here's a guy who has seen every known document dealing with polygamy, and he's getting back into the church. I like that part of the story.
Yeah, that is wonderful. And, I mean, the Jensen documents, that is a real coup. For those, again, who don't know, Andrew Jensen was he assistant church historian, or was he the actual church historian? I don't remember.
He was made an assistant church historian in 1897. He was actually an independent historian when he was gathering all the information on polygamy.
Right. So so he gathered a lot of this information, and I guess we've known some of the products of that research, but we haven't had the actual research itself, I guess, until you've published it here. So it's exciting stuff. And you're bringing up one thing that I really hope everybody who's listening realizes, that these books, I think their best thing about them, the thing that I admire the most, is they're almost source books for the topic. You could completely disagree with Brian's analysis of the evidence, and it's very easy to separate out what he thinks or what he concludes from that evidence himself. And I assume that was an intentional decision on your part.
Yeah, I hope that if people wanted to disagree with me, and believe me, there are lots that still do, that they would be quoting things that I have included in the books, because I didn't. I told Don, get any document, antagonistic, you know, anti-Mormon or apologetic and everything in between. It's all there. And then, of course, I list it all, and then I tell them what I think is the most valid interpretation.
Right. And so anybody who wants to make up their mind about this sort of stuff, these are the books to go to, because it's all laid out. I mean, I've kind of tried to do that on my own without these books, and it's a lot harder, as Brian can attest. You know, the books and articles that have been written really do tend to kind of pick and choose, as most scholarship has to, but it's very easy with that to kind of put a certain slant on the material, and I think that's one thing that's really to be admired about this collection, is that it really doesn't do that. You really do get to see everything, and you can kind of try to boil it down and decide what you think it all means. So go ahead. What were you going
to
say?
Well, I'm just grateful to Greg Coford and Greg Coford Books, and also I would mention Levina Fielding Anderson, who edited Volumes 1 and 2, and Lloyd Erickson, who edited Volume 3 and also did the typesetting, because they allowed us to do these large books. And in fact, when we sent the two manuscripts off, History and Theology, a day later, Lloyd, who was typesetting them, said, "Brian, History is over 1,000 pages, and that's if I put it on the 7x9 format." And so we talked to Greg, or he did, and Greg said, "Well, do Volumes 1 and 2 to be History." But, you know, a lot of publishers would have just said, "Go back and shorten it by half," or something, but Greg didn't make us do that, so I'm really grateful.
Yeah, and it's a much better work, I think, as a result of that. Even if your conclusions would have been the same, the use to, you know, people like me or our listeners is huge. So you mentioned, you know, help at the archives. people have occasionally asked me if, you know, I've written some stuff about plural marriage. They've occasionally asked me if I get any pushback from church leaders or members, and I frankly haven't. I've had members of my stake presidency just come up to me and say, hey, I read your thing on this, and I really enjoyed it, and, you know, I've never gotten any negative pushback. Have you? Is that something that's ever troubled people you're around?
Not at all. And people think that they're hiding stuff down there. I don't believe they're hiding anything on this topic. I don't think they're hiding anything at all, but certainly I would. My experience with them was that they were open. We gained access to every document that we asked for. In addition, they were very generous in helping me get the photos. They gave me like 50 photos without any charge. And they even let us get copies of the Andrew Jensen papers, which I have several of them that I reproduce in the book. And that's hugely generous. So, no, I they've been very helpful.
Yeah, and that's certainly what Donnell Bachman, who wrote one of the earliest and I think still best works on LDS plural marriage back in the 70s for his master's thesis at Purdue. He told me even back in the 70s when he was doing it, he had the exact same experience that you described. So one of the important points that you kind of started out with the book mentioning is that we need to appreciate something about the type of evidence that exists for studying this, because obviously there isn't all the evidence that we would like. What we'd really probably like is a journal in Joseph's own hand, you know, contemporaneously explaining how he experienced this and what he was thinking, but we just don't have that. And you make the point that about 98% of the documents that are out there are late reminiscences. Do you have anything to say about that or about the evidence kind of as a whole?
Well, I've had people say, Brian, quit quoting all these late recollections. Get some good evidence. And I'm thinking, okay, whatever you believe right now about Joseph Smith and polygamy is based on a late recollection, because that is really all there is. There's only two contemporaneous documents that are right from Joseph. One is section 132, the revelation, and then there are a few entries in William Clayton's journal that are contemporaneously recorded. Now, if we expand the circle a little bit, there are four anti-Mormon sources, one from William Law, who was a polygamy insider, but unfortunately he didn't write much about it, even in the Nauvoo Expositor and in his journal. There's John C. Bennett, who some people say was a polygamy insider, and they're wrong, and I'm more than happy to go the distance on that. If they want to try to show that he was, they've got some huge hurdles. We've got a guy named Oliver Olney, who started to keep a journal in Nauvoo when he was excommunicated in 1842, and he had some interesting things to say, but he was quite removed from what was going on. And then lastly, there's a man named Joseph H. Jackson, who had an awful lot to say but has no credibility because he wasn't a polygamy insider. So anyway, those are the six more or less contemporaneous sources, but only two of them really are closely tied to Joseph.
Right. And another point that you make that I think is an excellent one is in the 19th century or even beyond, as people began writing about polygamy, there was certainly much more fiction in the sense of, you know, novels and that sort of thing written about the Mormons than history or even what you might call journalism. And how do you see that having impacted how we see this topic today?
You're absolutely right. There is so much more fiction and historical fiction written about the Mormons and polygamy during the 19th century than there is anything else. But it is interesting also to note, and Don Bradley and I have an article in Volume 2 of The Persistence of Polygamy, which is edited by Craig Foster and Newell Breenhurst. It'll be out here in the next few weeks. But the article shows that the four primary groups or libraries of documents came to us as a result of the Utah Saints pushing back on the RLDS missionaries. In other words, you've got a bunch of affidavits collected in 1869 by Joseph F. Smith to prove the RLDS missionaries who said Joseph wasn't a polygamist, to prove them wrong. And then we've got the Andrew Jensen papers that I mentioned earlier, and then those papers were used to write an article that was published in 1887, which is very important. And then in 1892, the RLDS Church was suing to get possession of the Temple Lot in Independence, and the Temple Lot Church, called Hedrickites, they came out to Utah and got a bunch of people who were in Nauvoo and were polygamists to go and testify, and we get additional details. Had the RLDS Church not said Joseph was not a polygamist. In other words, if they hadn't portrayed him as being a monogamist only, the Utah Church may not have recorded any of these recollections, and we really would have been in trouble.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting thing how, you know, people will say the Church has hidden this, but in fact, the Church is really our major source for most of what we know. So let's talk about the origins of plural marriage. It's pretty common for people who come to this subject, especially if they know relatively little about Joseph or little about plural marriage, to make a very snap decision. And I think it's an understandable one to say, well, Joseph was a lustful person or he was living a licentious sort of life. He's just one example of someone who used religion for power and sex. And so I think that's an understandable knee-jerk reaction. But when we try to set that aside, what do you think the sources tell us about Joseph's behavior and character early on?
Well, it's interesting that Gerald and Sandra Tanner wrote in their book about Joseph Smith and polygamy that, and I'm going to have to paraphrase, but they asserted that that sexual impropriety was one of the most common accusations leveled at Joseph Smith during his lifetime. And that's just false. In fact, Don Bradley and I looked very diligently to find a single accusation of having been involved with sexual transgression during the 1830s and early 1840s prior to John Bennett getting into the picture, and we couldn't find any. There is one quote from Martin Harris that's very dubious that is found in Edie Howe's book, but it wasn't his reputation. People were not writing about Joseph being a womanizer or anything of the sort. This is not something that we can find documented in the historical record. But also, Greg, you made a good point, because Joseph Smith said God commanded him to practice plural marriage. But if we go into a group of people and we ask them how many of them believe in God, and a certain number of hands go up, and then you say to them, how many of those who believe God was talking to Joseph Smith? And then there's a few hands that go down, but maybe there's a few that are staying up. But those are the only people that are going to be able to believe Joseph's explanation. And by default, virtually everybody else is going to say, well, it was libido driven. He wanted to increase his sexual opportunities. It's a default position. We don't criticize them for this, because what else are they going to say? Oh, I bet he was a prophet and he was commanded to do it. They're not going to say that. They're going to say, oh, you know, it's probably libido. And again, we aren't surprised by that. And this is before we've even gotten into the evidence. But as somebody who's tried to see every bit of evidence on this topic, what I'm finding there are things that support my position that he was a true prophet, a sincere man, a reluctant polygamist. And so if we go to the documents, we don't find a smoking gun from some woman saying Joseph debauched me or seduced me. It's just not there. People have been taking ambiguous evidence and spinning it in a way that portrays him negatively, because the evidence that he was a womanizer is just not there in any kind of credible way, at least from my research.
Yeah, and that was certainly my experience. I mean, that's kind of how I came to this topic, is reading, you know, a few pages of Van Wagener's book where he kind of sets that out in about a page and then moves on. And I thought, whoa, you know, I need to look at this. And I was astonished at how little foundation there was to that when you kind of unpacked it all. It's interesting, too, to me, I think, that Joseph wasn't accused of that sort of thing, given that that was a very common charge to make against early religious innovators at the time. You know, you didn't have to be deeply involved in some kind of perverse or corrupt sexual life to be accused of that sort of thing if you were a religious innovator. So it's even more astonishing to me how little there is about Joseph at the beginning.
Well, and you know, it's interesting to me, because in one thing that makes Joseph different from, say, Jim Jones or David Koresh, who's Vernon Howell, or Jeff Lundgren, these are leaders of religious movements who were having sex with their followers, you know, after a while, after they became the leader. And in contrast, Joseph Smith, through the Book of Mormon in 1829, even before he'd established the church, he taught that sexual transgression was next to murder in its severity. And I know there's some people who say, no, that's not the right interpretation. I disagree. Heber C. Kimball quoted it that way in 1857. But he sets up the law of chastity as being something that's very important to obey. And he does this even before he sets up a church. And then what we find, just months before he's martyred, Joseph Smith has the temple endowment ceremony being administered to women. And in those ceremonies, they make many covenants, one of which is to obey the law of chastity. Here you have these moral bookends, and Joseph reiterated the need to be sexually pure many times in between. But whatever he's doing, the people around him know without any question that he believes in the law of chastity and the importance of keeping it. And so people who portray Joseph as running around as a womanizer, as a licentious guy, it doesn't fit. There were too many people who would not have put up with the hypocrisy.
Yeah, like I think you say quite well in the book, you know, people claiming that today claim to be able to see what Joseph's closest friends and contemporaries could not see. So the first plural marriage that we know of was Fanny Alger, dated, I think, between 1833 and to 35. I think you, like me, tend to incline towards the later end of that time frame, 35. The first thing people often notice about that is they say, well, wait a minute, no matter which date you pick for that, 33, 34, 35, that's still at least a year before Elijah appears in the Kirtland Temple in 1836 and restores sealing keys. So the first question you have to ask about Fanny, I think, is, well, how can you have a plural marriage when you don't even have keys? How do you look at that?
A very good question, and one that is very commonly asked. What I believe is happening, and the timeline for me, one key element, it comes from Mary Elizabeth Rollins, and she said, at least on a couple of occasions, that Joseph told her that the angel came three times, and the first visit was in 1834. So I think the angel came and said, Joseph, we want you to do this. And so this got him thinking about it, and that's why this marriage occurred in 35 by my timing. But as far as the authority to use it, it is also during this period that Joseph stepped forward to perform marriage ceremonies, monogamous ones, for men and women using priesthood authority. This is authority of the priesthood, which he had received from Peter, James, and John. It wasn't sealing authority. These weren't eternal marriages. But it was priesthood authority that allowed the couple to be legally married according to God's laws for the span of earth life. And this authority coming from Peter, James, and John, from God, would have allowed him to perform a polygamous marriage as easily as a monogamous marriage within his own teachings and if God would allow a monogamous, he would have allowed a polygamous, because both of those types of marriages are allowed by priesthood authority in the Old Testament. So to me, it was just a four-time only marriage performed by priesthood authority, the same kind that he used to marry Lydia Goldthwaite, and I may be blocking on her name, and was it Newell?
Newell Whitney.
Yeah. But anyway, that same authority could have easily done the polygamous marriage, and he gave it to Levi. We have the account, and then we have the new account from Eliza R. Snow that Don Bradley discovered, where she was there, she knew what was going on, and she, in her own hand, wrote that Fanny Alger was a plural wife of Joseph. So these are some strong evidences that a plural marriage ceremony was performed.
Right. Yeah, so I think the important thing to remember is we today are inclined to think of plural marriage and eternal marriage as kind of two sides of a coin, but you have to remember that they're not necessarily. There's marriage, and then there's the eternal aspect of it, and at this point, that eternal aspect wasn't so much on the radar, I don't think. So one of the very few relatively contemporaneous documents about plural marriage actually involves the Fanny Alger marriage. It's, as you know, a letter from Oliver Cowdery to his brother Warren. And this is a document that gets quoted all the time because it has some fairly juicy little bits in it. And it's usually quoted as Oliver saying that this was a, quote, dirty, nasty, filthy affair, close quote. So, I mean, that's a good blurb to put on the front of your book, you might say, for some people. So can you talk about that document a bit more and what we should think about as we evaluate that sort of a claim?
Yeah, and a very good point. But let me back up. What's interesting about the Fanny Alger relationship is nobody mentions it in any document that we have found prior to 1838, the letter that you have just mentioned. And the reason that might be significant is that whatever fervor, whatever rumors and gossip were going around Kirtland at the time, nobody wrote it down. Nobody reported it to the newspaper, who would have been very happy to publish it.
Right.
So it wasn't like everybody knew about it. Now, there is a recollection that in 1837 people were talking about it, but whatever it was or wasn't, nobody mentioned it in any contemporaneous document. And then we have Oliver Cowdery in his – he had a letter book that was kept by Warren F. Cowdery, who was his nephew.
Okay.
And what Oliver did is he wrote the letter to his brother, Warren A. Cowdery. And then it was transcribed, that letter was transcribed into the letter book by Warren F. Cowdery. But what's interesting is the word affair is an overwrite. The underlying word is scrape. Dirty, nasty, filthy, scrape. And I'm indebted to Don Bradley for sleuthing that out. It's some amazing work in my mind. Is that a big deal? Not really. I've been criticized for spending a couple of pages on it, but I think it's pretty cool that Don could figure that out. But it also needs to, people who want to say Oliver said it was an affair need to back away from that. We don't know who did the overwrite or why. The only word that can be traced back to the original is the word scrape. And I will concede, and I do it in the books, that Oliver and Emma, we could throw her in there too, whether they knew about a marriage ceremony, and I'm quite sure that they knew about it, they rejected it. They didn't think it was legitimate. They didn't think this was a legitimate plural marriage. The question for me, though, is, was this a marriage according to Joseph Smith's teachings? Was there a ceremony performed? Because that's what would have been required. And the evidence is strong that there was, but that Oliver and Emma and others rejected that it was legitimate.
Right. And it's probably worth pointing out, too, that the word affair at the time probably didn't have the same connotation that we put on it. If I say someone's having an affair or they were involved in an affair, I usually mean a sexual impropriety. Back then, it could be a situation or, you know, it was a little more general, even though I think we have to concede that there is a sexual element to what Oliver's talking about there.
Very good point.
So this is one question that I want to ask you, maybe a bit of a trivial bit, but I've wondered what you would think of it. As you know, one of the sources for the Fanny Alger marriage is letters written by a former apostle, William McClellan, to Joseph Smith III. He wrote two letters, I believe, and I think spoke to the newspaper about it as well. And he was basically writing to Joseph to say, no, Joseph, your father was a polygamist, and kind of egging him on to talk to his mother about it. And McClellan claimed that Emma had told him, McClellan, about this. And I've always been a bit skeptical of that story. McClellan later apostatized, and when Joseph was put in Liberty Jail, McClellan sought for the opportunity to actually beat Joseph up. And Joseph, I think, essentially said that he would do it if he could be unchained. He was willing to let McClellan have a go, and McClellan didn't want to do that, and the jailer refused to let Joseph be beaten while he was chained, so it didn't happen. I don't think McClellan would have done too well against Joseph unchained, and I think McClellan probably thought so too. And then later, McClellan went and ransacked Joseph and Emma's home, stole some of their belongings, stole their bedding while Joseph was freezing in Liberty Jail. And Emma asked him why he was doing all this, and he said, because I can. So my question to you is, with all that in the past, how likely do you think it is that Emma would ever really unburden herself to McClellan about what was obviously a personal, deeply painful matter for her? Do you think he's at all credible on this point, or is he just spreading gossip and lying about hearing it from Emma?
Wow, Greg, that's some really good research. I do treat what McClellan wrote about Fanny Alger as credible. But I don't discuss these elements that contextualize it and cast some doubt on how objective he could have been. The biggest problem, though, with the letters that he wrote is that he talks about an affair with Fanny Alger, but he also references a Miss Hill, and so many antagonistic authors have wanted to say Joseph had two affairs.
Right.
And I believe, like Val Avery and Linda King Newell, that he just got his names mixed up, because when he was asked about this 3 years later in an interview, he only reported one relationship, and it bore characteristics of both his descriptions of Fanny Alger and Miss Hill's involvement with Joseph. So That's where I think people are misreading McClellan.
Right. Yeah. And, I mean, my sense of McClellan is I get the suspicion that, you know, he had heard the rumors and stuff, and so he put it in Emma's mouth to try to twist Joseph Smith III's arm. But I'm not convinced that, because Emma rarely, if ever, admitted plural marriage to anybody, ever, you know. And I just find it hard to believe that of all the people she's going to unburden herself to, it's going to be McClellan, you know, this guy who robs her family, tries to beat her husband, steals her bedding when, you know, it just doesn't ring true to me, but... anyway.
Good point.
So after Fanny, which was obviously a difficult experience for everybody involved, Joseph, Emma, Oliver, anybody who knew, they were not having a great time with it. There's really nothing more on the plural marriage front until about 1840. And as you mentioned, there are reports of Joseph telling people from time to time about an angel repeatedly coming to command him to implement plural marriage. And you found some new stuff about that. What can you tell us about that?
In one of the chapters, I've accumulated 22 accounts coming from 9 individuals, all of whom knew Joseph. Now, they don't all claim to have heard him say it personally, but they all knew Joseph, and they all have reports of that an angel came to him. And then Mary Elizabeth Rollins gave us additional details of that there were 3 visits, and the angel in the last visit had a sword, and that he was commanding plural marriage. These are also available in an article that was published in Mormon Historical Studies a while back.
Okay, so that's a good reference for people to check out. So there is, you know, I've heard someone actually ask me recently, is that just a rumor? And no, it's not a rumor. I mean, there's quite a few sources on that. So after 1840, Joseph was sealed to Louisa Beeman, and then he began to do, and I think you alluded to this earlier, about the question you always got asked and you didn't have a good answer for. Probably the thing about plural marriage that's the strangest to us, it's the thing that certainly in my experience bothers people more than anything else, and that's this polyandry. And for our listeners who don't know, in an LDS history context, what polyandry means is it's the practice of marrying or being sealed to a woman who already has a living husband. So you've published a lot about polyandry. I think this is something where you've broken some new ground. So can you help us understand that? What's going on with polyandry?
Yeah, it's probably the most puzzling occurrence or event associated with Joseph Smith and plural marriage. And it's the one issue that got me researching this topic of Joseph Smith in general and plural marriage, because it just didn't feel right. People are saying, oh, yeah, Joseph married these women. They had legal husbands. And then he spends a night with them and then sends them home to spend a night with their legal husband. That just never felt right to me. As we look at the actual historical documents, what we find are that there were 14 women who had legal husbands at the time that they were sealed to Joseph Smith. And to understand what's happening here, we have to make a couple of observations, some of which will be new. First is that in Nauvoo, Joseph Smith allowed some women to be sealed not for time and eternity, but for eternity only. In other words, there were some women like Ruth Vo Sayers, whose husband was a non-member. And so Ruth is saying, well, what do I do? And her husband, who liked Joseph a great deal, Joseph hid at their house when the Missourians were calling one time. And her husband, Edward, liked Joseph. And Edward said to Ruth, go ahead and be sealed to Joseph for the next life. You're going to be my wife now, which means he's not sharing her sexually with Joseph in any way, but you can be sealed to him for the next life because I don't believe in that stuff anyway. And so she did. And we have this recorded in the Andrew Jensen papers that she went to Joseph and was sealed to him only for eternity. Now, in my research, I believe 11 of the 14 women were sealed to Joseph just for the next life. There's no evidence of sexual relations between them and Joseph. And I believe that they were just sealed to him. And why would they do this? Well, Lucy Walker, one of Joseph Smith's plural wives, recorded that Joseph said that a woman would have her choice. This was a privilege that could not be denied her. And apparently these 11 women chose Joseph over their legal husbands. And of course, some of the men were not members or were inactive, but some of the men were active members. And we don't know why they would do that, but we do know none of the men complained, none of the women complained. This was their choice. But for the other 3 women, these were time and eternity marriages with sexuality. And so you got to say, okay, what's going on there. And something that's been ignored by virtually everybody who has written on this topic is things that are found in Section 132 and also Section 22, because in Section 22 it says, "Behold, I say unto you that all old covenants have I caused to be done away in this thing, and this is a new and everlasting covenant." And then in Section 134, as the Revelation is going to tell us about the new and everlasting, about polygamy, it says, "Behold, I reveal unto you a new and everlasting covenant." And what this means is that a sealing in the new and everlasting covenant, whether would have superseded all old matrimonial covenants. That is, after a legal marriage would have been done away. The new and everlasting covenant causes the old marriage covenant to be done away. So the woman would not have two husbands after she's been sealed in the new and everlasting covenant. The second marriage, the legal marriage, would have been done away, and in God's eyes, she still would have only had one husband. Of the three women, and their names are Sarah Ann Whitney and Sylvia Sessions, we know from the historical record these women were physically separated from their husbands. So the sealing to Joseph would not have changed anything for them. But Mary Heron is the last woman, and we just don't know much about her. The documentation is so poor that anybody who's given us details either has documents that I have not seen, or they're making it up. So we just don't know the details there. But what I can tell you is that regarding sexual polyandry, there's just no evidence that it happened, but there's also nobody explaining or defending it. And none of the husbands, wives, officiators, witnesses, even the anti-Mormons did not complain about this behavior. And I think that's all very consistent with the observation or my conclusion that it didn't happen and wouldn't have. But what's also important, Greg, is that in Section 132, Joseph Smith describes three sexually polyandrous relationships and labels them all adultery, in two cases saying the woman would be destroyed. So I believe Joseph would not have tolerated it in himself or others, and had it occurred, it would have been adultery. People who want to believe in sexual polyandry and Joseph's plural marriages need to produce some documentation instead of Fawn Brody level speculations.
Amen on Brody.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I kind of, when I started looking at this myself, I kind of assumed as I began looking at it that there was sexuality in most of these polyandrous marriages, you know, and then the more I looked at it, the more I began to think, oh, maybe there's not. But I worried about two things. I mean, I worried, one, that as a believing member, maybe I was kind of trying to skew that data, and even if I wasn't, then I figured other people would think that. And then the one other part of it that really stuck for me was the Sylvia Sessions case, you know, where you have somebody who's probably our best case for a wife conceiving a child by Joseph. And you wrote a paper, that's one of the first things I read by you on it, and it really kind of cleared out this fog. So tell us a little more, if you can, about Sylvia and what you discovered about her and her current marital state, you might say, during her sealing to Joseph.
Well, Sylvia is a very, very important plural wife for several reasons, one of which that Todd Compton, in his award-winning book, In Sacred Loneliness, outlines a timeline which implies rather strongly sexual polyandry was part of Joseph Smith's behavior. And Todd and I still disagree about this, but part of the problem with Todd's reconstruction is that he uses a document from the 1869 affidavit books that were put together by Joseph F. Smith. It's not an affidavit. It was never signed. And it talks about Sylvia Session Lyon and when she was sealed to Joseph. And it gives a date of February 8th of 1842. And so Todd says that's the date, even though this is not signed, and then makes the assumption that that the child, who's not conceived for a year later, but that Joseph was having sexual relationships with Sylvia, and we know during that immediate period, Sylvia was living in the home of Windsor Lyon, so the assumption is it's sexual polyandry. The problem is, and this is the discovery actually that I made, was if you look closely at the affidavit books, in book one is the date of February 8th, 1842, but the similar document is found in the book four that uses an 1843 date. And if you look at the books, actually the book four is probably the more authoritative. So the timeline presented by Todd Compton in Sacred Loneliness is not reliable.
And just for our listeners, I'll point out there's these two affidavits books. These were collected by Joseph F. Smith. There were two books, and then they made copies of each one. So 1 and 4 are basically copies of each other, though they're not exact copies, and 2 and 3 are copies of each other. But again, there's some differences between them. Have I got that right?
Yeah, it's important, though, to distinguish that. But saying that they're copies is not as accurate as saying they are exact duplicates, because they contain in them a number of affidavits that have a seal from a notary in them and a justice of the peace. And books 3 and 4 are not just a copy of that. They have the same notary and the same original signatures. Mm. So they're exact duplicates. And it wasn't like somebody just miscopied one and put a 43 date. That isn't
right.
It. And no one can say that the 42 date is more authoritative than 43. And if you had to make a call, there's a couple of reasons to think 43 might be more authoritative. But another problem is that February 8th is actually the birth date of the child who I believe was fathered by Joseph Smith. And so the idea that Joseph would have been sealed to her and then she would have gotten pregnant and delivered exactly a year later is just improbable, but not impossible.
Right. So that maybe brings us to the question of children and sexual relations. So we don't have good evidence for this sexual polyandry, as you're calling it, you know, women having two sexual partners at once. What do we know about the sexuality in these other relationships to the single women, you might say, who are married or sealed to Joseph?
On my website, which is josephsmithspolygamy.com, and also Appendix E in Volume 2, I list all of the evidence I've been able to find regarding sexual relations in Joseph Smith's plural marriages. And I conclude that there's good evidence that they occurred in 12 of the marriages, with some ambiguous evidence in 3 more. And it is important, as you just mentioned, these 15 women are not the 14-year-old wives. There were 2 of those. They are not the polyandrous wives we've talked about, and they are not non-wives. We have no non-wives saying they had sex with Joseph. That does not occur in the historical record so far as I've been able to discover. But regarding the children, we find, I think, 2. And one is Sylvia Session Lyon's daughter, Josephine, that you've alluded to. And she grew to adulthood, married a guy named Fisher, and they settled in Bountiful. And if you know any Fishers that live in Bountiful, they probably have Joseph's DNA in them. At least that's my opinion. The other child was born to Olive Frost. We don't even have a gender because she and the child both died before the Saints left Nauvoo. I also have in my book and on the website accumulated 18 other names of children that were supposedly, in somebody's mind, children of Joseph Smith. The most likely candidates, 6 of them, have been discounted through DNA testing done by Hugo Perrigo. And the other ones are really, really implausible. Anybody who got pregnant within 20 miles of Joseph Smith's location, somebody out there is probably saying Joseph is the father. It's impressive.
You're right. It is impressive, the reach on some. Well, and for our readers, I mean, when we post this interview, I'm going to, on the webpage, post some links to these questions. So people who want to see more evidence, you know, we'll post a link to your page there, and people can check some of this out. I have a table that I've made that's on the FAIR website that breaks down all the children who have ever been claimed and kind of sets it out for you, so you can have kind of a bird's eye view of what this evidence looks like.
Super.
So we've talked about how the kind of default setting for understanding Joseph and his plural marriage is to assume that it's kind of about sex and power. And I think one of the most potent narratives with that, or potent to things that people kind of throw out there, is this idea that Joseph would call men on missions and then kind of steal their wives while they were gone. What can you tell us about that?
You know, the first person to make that accusation, I think, was John C. Bennett. And people naturally accept Bennett as being a polygamy insider and somebody that they could actually believe. I hold the exact opposite position. I think the evidence is extremely strong that Bennett never once sat down with Joseph Smith to learn about plural marriage. The evidence is very compelling. But he was the first to mention this, and it's been echoed by a number of authors over the decades. The problem is nobody's actually looked to find out if there was any truth to it. And Todd Compton lists 12 wives that had legal husbands, and I have added 2 more. For a total of 14 of the Joseph's plural wives had legal husbands. Of those men, 11 of them were not on missions at the time Joseph was sealed to their legal wives. And of the three that were, the only one that we know was on a mission is Orson Hyde. And Orson Hyde had been on his mission over a year before Joseph was sealed to Miranda. And the dating of that is a little problematic, but if we believe the source, then he had been gone for over a year. So that doesn't exactly paint the picture of Joseph sending a man out and then running after his wife to be sealed to him. But that's the only one. In the other two cases, we know that Joseph was sealed to the woman, but we don't, and the men did serve missions while the saints were in Nauvoo, but we don't have a date for the sealing. So there's no way to know of any possible relationship. So people who are saying that Joseph Smith sent men on missions so he could marry their wives just don't know what the historical evidence is telling us, because it's just not true.
Right. And it's, I think it's worth pointing out, too, that when Orson Hyde came back, that sealing was reaffirmed. I mean, he was aware of it, and then they did it again, sort of in sort of a validating sort of a way.
We do have two dates for Miranda, and we're not sure what that all means, but we do know that she that he had Joseph Smith seal a plural wife to him within 2 or 3 months. And if he was upset with Joseph about this, that is a little strange behavior.
Right. So going along with that theme, one of the other things that you'll hear sometimes is that Joseph would threaten or manipulate or coerce women into these relationships. I think we see the same kind of trouble with historical evidence in that case, but what can you tell us about that?
Well, there's one story that is often told, and George D. Smith in his book Nauvoo Polygamy most recently has reiterated this, and it's the story of Lucy Walker. And what happened is that, according to the shortened version, which is what everybody seems to want to tell, Joseph meets Lucy Walker, gives her 24 hours and an ultimatum that if she doesn't decide, then the gates will be closed against her forever. And so she acquiesces because he's putting all this pressure on her. Now, those facts are actually true. But what they don't tell you is the rest of the story. Joseph actually had proposed plural marriage and had introduced plural marriage to Lucy Walker at least 4 months before, and it could have been as much as 16 months. He talked to her about it the year previous. And then she tells us that she was depressed. She just felt awful. She couldn't make a decision. And then she tells us that Joseph saw her great turmoil. And it was only after Joseph saw the turmoil that Lucy Smith had that Joseph says, okay, let's get this resolved. I'm going to give you 24 hours and then the offer's off and you won't have the chance to do this. That night, Lucy Walker prayed very fervently. She had an extra worldly experience with an angel. And, or something, there's two or three descriptions of it, but it was something that made her believe that this was okay with God and that she should go ahead. And then the next day she went with Joseph, to Joseph with the answer, and, Joseph sat her down and gave her a blessing, which isn't exactly what you would think he would do if libido was driving this whole process. So this is the only woman that we have any kind of a story of an ultimatum from Joseph. And it wasn't Joseph trying to get into bed with this woman, so he quickly tells her 24 hours, and that's how it's portrayed over and over by the anti-Mormons and by other authors. That's not what happened. We also find, though, that there are two, that John C. Bennett, again quoting Bennett, he said that Joseph's line was, if you don't marry me, I'll destroy your reputation. Again, coercion. Threats portrayed by Bennett. Bennett, I think, is a prevaricator. He's wrong. It didn't happen that way. As you have pointed out, Greg, Joseph was turned down by several women. And the only reason we know about him, there's five of them, and they're in my book, and they're on my website. But the only reason we know Joseph proposed to these women is because those women later talked about it, or one of their family members did. And it wasn't, Joseph didn't destroy their reputation. One of the women, Sarah Kimball, said, don't teach me about polygamy. And Joseph said, well, God has commanded me to teach you. Who do you want me to teach it to? And she goes, well, go teach it to somebody else. And he says, well, I will pray for you. And that was the end of it. And then Sarah later related this story. But to say that Joseph had made this threat to anybody is just not supported. Now, there were two exceptions. One is Nancy Rigdon and the other is Sarah Pratt. Both of these women, and actually it wasn't Nancy Rigdon so much as some of her family members, but they came out and made accusations that were public in Nauvoo against Joseph. And Joseph defended himself. Same with Sarah Pratt. She made some very outlandish claims against Joseph, and others took those and embellished them beyond what Sarah actually said. But in both of these cases, I would argue that based on the five women that turned him down and nothing happened until they later talked about it to tell us that it happened, that if Sarah Pratt and Nancy Rigdon had kept it silent, quiet, that Joseph would not have said anything more about it any more than he had with the other five women.
Yeah. And, I mean, turning Joseph down for plural marriage, if anything, if that got out, that'd be more likely to elevate your moral standing, not decrease it. I think he's a sociopath. I mean, I've written some about that, and he's just he's a real piece of work. And so it's, as you say, really amusing to see people treat him like he's this bastion of information. He can tell you a bit, but even people in the time didn't really buy Bennett's version much.
That's right. You have written about him. I'd forgotten.
Yeah. So that brings us to one other issue, going in with this issue of power or control. And one of the things in my experience that troubles people almost more than anything else, probably only polyandry bothers them more, is this question of Joseph marrying women who are under age 18, especially two that were 14 years old, Nancy Winchester and Helen Mar Kimball, I think. So some people have said that makes Joseph a kind of sexual predator or this sort of thing. What would you say about that?
Well, and I know, Greg, that you have expertise on this, too, so feel free to expand. But my research reveals, first off, with respect to Nancy Winchester, she probably was 14. She might have been 15. We just don't know, and we know absolutely nothing about that. If somebody says there were sexual relations on there, that's pure speculation. There's just nothing out there to tell us what was going on. Now, Helen Mar Kimball is a very interesting case because she became sealed to Joseph because her father wanted this to happen. And in her late account, 1881 account, she paints herself as a ewe lamb that her father offered up to Joseph to try to, I guess, create a better bond between Joseph and Heber. And Helen Mar was kind of offered up. And Joseph did go along. But the point that I would make is there's absolutely no evidence of sexual relations. And what we have from her is a poem that was written in 1881 where she complains that she felt like a fettered bird. And people have said, see, she was stuck with Joseph and wanted to be out with her friends that were the same age and all. I argue that while Todd Compton says this is entirely ambiguous, I think that if she were having sexual relations with Joseph at that time, that she may not have been pining for her friends and others, that she would have seen herself as a true wife and been more worried about getting pregnant, being a mother, and these kinds of things. I think the fact that she wanted to go to the dances was and all she saw this ceiling was something that was limiting her from being able to socialize because there was no other physical manifestation. Now, that's an interpretive thing, and people can disagree with it, but what's important is a new observation, and this is something from the Temple Lot case. And just to give a little bit of history, in 1892, the RLDS Church tried to get ownership of the temple lot in Independence. They had earlier asserted authority over the Kirtland Temple, and their argument was that they were the same church that Joseph Smith established. That church originally owned the land, therefore their successor, the RLDS Church, owned it now. And it was a fairly simple argument. Now, the temple lot owners, they are called the Hedrickites by some. They don't like that name, but that's a name that some of you may have heard. The Hedrickites, of course, were fighting against this, and their logic was to say Joseph Smith taught polygamy and practiced it. The RLDS Church is not, therefore they are not the true successors. It's a fairly easy argument to make. And so trying to prove that Joseph practiced full polygamy was very important. And what they did is they brought the attorneys, Parley, Pratt, Kelly, and Edwin L. Kelly, for the RLDS Church, and then they had an attorney named Southern, and the church was helping the Temple Lot to try to prove, one, that Joseph was practicing polygamy, and to prevent the RLDS Church from getting control over the Temple Lot. And so they came out to Utah. Wilford Woodruff was involved, and they were asking the plural wives to come and testify. Well, there were nine of Joseph Smith's plural wives that were still alive. Three of them were polyandrous wives. None of them were called to come and testify that they had been full plural wives of Joseph Smith. And by full, I mean sexual plural wives, because for them to say, oh, I was just an eternity only wife, or I was just a spiritual wife without any kind of physical interaction, that would have played right into the hands of the RLDS attorneys, because that's, they were just saying Joseph didn't practice full polygamy. So the only witnesses that they wanted to call were some that could say to them, I had carnal intercourse with Joseph as his plural wife. Well, they called first, Melissa Lott came up from Lehi, and she testified that she had relations with Joseph. They also called Emily Partridge, who lived in Salt Lake, and she testified that she had relations with Joseph, physical relations. It's very pointed questions if you read the account.
Yeah, especially for the time. It's pretty in your face.
Yeah, the wording is not what would have made them very comfortable to admit. But then a strange thing happens. Helen Marr Kimball, who was a plural wife of Joseph Smith, but was 14 at the time, and she just lived a few blocks away from the deposition room here in Salt Lake City, and she had written two pamphlets that were directed at the RLDS Church defending the fact that Joseph had practiced plural marriage. They didn't call her, and yet we have her journal. Todd Compton actually was one who transcribed part of the journal. And in her journal entries for the time, she knew that these depositions were taking place. Nobody is asking her to show up and give a deposition. Instead, Wilford Woodruff himself writes a letter to Lucy Walker, who lived in Logan. And coming down from Logan was kind of a big deal. She probably took the train. We actually don't know how she got to Salt Lake, but it would have been a big deal. And she comes down and she testifies that she also had physical relations with Joseph. So the only people, the only wives of Joseph Smith that they called were wives that could testify of full polygamous marriage with Joseph Smith. And they didn't call Helen. And I believe this is an important observation, because I think if she could have testified of having sexual relations with Joseph as his plural wife, they would have called her in a second.
Right.
She would have been an excellent witness. The fact that they didn't call her needs explanation from those who think that there was sexual relations in that relationship.
Right. And as plural marriage expanded into Utah, again, you might see a marriage of a 14-year-old, but typically the practice was to say, you know, you won't be cohabitating until some years later. So that may well have tied into how things started in Nauvoo.
Well, and has you've shown in your writings, Greg, how a 16-year-old wife in Nauvoo wouldn't really have been a problem. A 14-year-old wife in Nauvoo would have been eyebrow-raising. You know, people have said, oh, you know, it was no big deal. Well, my research suggested it would have been a big deal. It wouldn't have been scandalous.
Right, not unheard of, but certainly out of the ordinary.
Right. But and some have said, well, the reason they didn't call her is they didn't want people to know that Joseph was sealed to her at 14. I say that's I disbelieve that and strongly, because while it would have been eyebrow raising, it wouldn't have been scandalous, and if they could have brought Helen Marr in there to testify against these RLDS attorneys, they would have done it in a second. That's what I believe.
Right. Yeah, Craig Foster, David Keller, and I have written a paper that I'll link to for our readers that where we actually tried to do a statistical analysis comparing Joseph Smith to other Mormons in the Nauvoo and Illinois area, other non-Mormons in the area, and what it comes out as is that Joseph Smith's wives, both for his age group and for any age group, are not statistically different. Some people have responded to that by saying, oh, well, you know, you talk about how things are different on the frontier, but Nauvoo's not the frontier. It's got nice roads and brick houses. And what those people fail to understand is the question isn't, you know, are you living in squalor or poverty? That's not what makes the frontier. What makes the frontier is what the economic opportunities are, because young men to get married need to have a way to support a wife and themselves. And so back east in, say, New England, where the Saints started out, where things were very established, people tended to get married later in life because it took a long time to amass the capital, you might say, to own a farm or however you're going to support a wife. Whereas out on the frontier, not only was land cheap, but you needed a wife. You needed a husband-wife team to economically make a go of it. So if you compare Joseph to people back in New England, it was different. But people tended to, on the frontier, marry younger, and that's just what the statistics show. So I often hear people complain that one thing that bothers them about plural marriage is that Emma Smith didn't know about it. They'll say, you know, Emma didn't know, Joseph was doing this behind her back. What would you say to that? Is that true? What did Emma know, and when did she know it?
Very, very good question. Again, these are the ones that are troublesome to me as well. However, I believe Joseph didn't want to practice plural marriage. Now, this is not all of the people who write about Joseph. Seriously, all of them portray him as this libido-driven guy wanting to jump into bed with as many women as he can, calling it polygamy, and then some of them will soften it a little and try to make him a little more sincere. But I don't see that. In fact, I think there's some pretty good evidence that Joseph didn't want to do it. And let me explain where this comes from. We have Joseph, his marriage to Fanny Alger in 35. It blows up in his face. It hurts Emma deeply. And then he gets the sealing authority in 1836. And when does he first use that authority? It's not for 5 years. And what we learn is that the angel came three times, once in 34. We don't know when the second one was, but I believe it was sometime prior to 1841. And Joseph, he's got this authority to seal. He doesn't use it. And the question in my mind is, why didn't he? And I think the answer is simply that if somebody can be sealed to a living wife, and let's say they're a widower, and they can be sealed to a dead wife, the next question out of their mouth is, well, can I be sealed to two living wives? And the answer is, well, yeah, this authority allows that. And that's a question Joseph did not want to answer. He didn't want to go there. So the angel shows up and says, Joseph, we want you to do this. So in 1841, a very curious thing happens. He gets married to Louisa Beeman, as you mentioned, and there is sexual relations there. We've got good evidence for that. But then Joseph goes on a spree of proposing to legally married women. And whether it's six or eight, by Joseph is proposing to them, I think these are all eternity-only marriages without sexuality. I believe the reason he did this was he was trying to satisfy the angel and get the angel off his back, but also enter into relationships that would not hurt Emma. Now, I understand people are going to be rolling their eyes when they listen to this, but look at the evidence, because what we get from Mary Elizabeth Rollins, who was a plural wife, Joseph told her that the third visit of the angel occurred in February, early February of 1842. Well, in early February 1842, Joseph Smith had been sealed to Louisa Beeman with sexual relations, and then he had been sealed to several other women with legal husbands, and what I believe are eternity-only sealings. But you got to ask yourself, why does the angel appear with a sword in February of 1842 to command Joseph to be practicing plural marriage when he's already been doing it for 10 months? What is not happening in those plural marriages that the angel wants to have happen? And then after this visit, after the time of about February, March of 1842, three changes occur. Joseph had taught other people about plural marriage, but nobody else had entered into it. And we find shortly thereafter, both Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball are proposing to women to gain a plural wife. But then two things happen in Joseph's own practices. One is he starts proposing to women who do not have legal husbands. And that the first woman he is Nancy Rigdon, who turns him down flat. But Nancy is the second previously unmarried woman that Joseph proposes to in Nauvoo, and it occurs just weeks after this third angel visit. The other thing that occurs is we start finding him proposing to women and entering into plural marriages where later we have good documentation of sexual relations. So I see in this pattern, and again, people are pushing back. I've had church historians say, Brian, I disagree. I've had anti-Mormons saying, Brian, I disagree. And that's fine, but how do you explain the angel showing up in 42 when Joseph has already got at least a half a dozen plural wives. And so I think Joseph didn't want to hurt Emma. But after that third angel visit, then Joseph goes ahead. He starts being sealed to these women. And then in the spring of 1843, somehow Emma learns about plural marriage, and she may have learned about the eternity-only ceilings first, only later to realize that there were time and eternity ceilings as well. And why did Joseph wait? That's a very important question. The reason is that, and we get this from Lorenzo Snow, that as soon as a person in Nauvoo was taught about plural marriage, they were expected to live that principle. But prior to teaching them about it, then they weren't required, obviously. And so Joseph waited until he believed Emma would accept it. And that apparently by the spring of 1843 was the time she did accept it. She gave Joseph four plural wives. And for a few weeks, she was willing to, and it may have been just a few days. It wasn't very long, but she did participate. She tried very hard. And after that point is when she kind of went on the warpath, and that's when Hiram asked Joseph to write down a revelation. We get section 132. I don't know how much chronology you want me to go through here, Greg, but I can carry it through if you'd like.
No, but I think you've laid that out really well. Yeah, and for what it's worth, I came to the same sort of conclusion with the angel and stuff. And the sticker for me was because Compton had another wife, the widow of Morgan, in there in 1838. But I think that dating, as you point out, is subject to some question. So if you're wrong, you and I are both wrong together, and sincerely so, I suppose.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great. I agree with you.
Yeah. So you've written, I think, quite movingly. It was one of my favorite parts of the book, and it brought up a little angle I hadn't thought about before, about the very unique dilemma that this put Emma in. I confess, and I had to repent a little bit. When I thought about Emma, I'd always say, well, yeah, this was tough for Emma, but, I mean, Heber C. Kimball had a wife, and it was tough for her, and Brigham Young had a wife, and it was tough for her. You know, there were plenty of women who I thought, you know, this has got to be equally tough for them, and yet they seem to come to some kind of spiritual peace with it. But you pointed out that Emma did have one thing to cope with that they didn't.
In fact, I'm indebted to Don Bradley for pointing this out. I finally listed Don as an assistant because I was stealing all these great ideas he was sharing with me. He actually stayed at my home for a year and a half while he was working on his master's thesis, and we'd go out running and had lots of great talks. And he observed that Emma was in the position of a woman who knew about Joseph's libido and his virility, and she was the only one in Nauvoo who could look at polygamy as maybe coming right from Joseph's own hormones, because maybe he saw her as inadequate in that area. Everybody else, every other woman, every other man in Nauvoo could blame Joseph or blame Joseph's revelations for polygamy. Emma, though, she knew Joseph very well, and she could have this additional doubt that, you know, maybe this is something that has to do with me more personally. She definitely had the most difficult row to hoe of all polygamists, I think, in the history of polygamy in this dispensation.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful line, I don't know if you mentioned it in the book, but where I think it's in Brigham Young's journal history, where he talks about Heber C. Kimball, when Heber C. Kimball was taught the doctrine, he was told, it was Brigham himself. Brigham himself was quite worried about, I'm going to try, he essentially said, but I don't know if I can do this. You know, what if I blow it? And the Lord kind of promised him that he wouldn't, even a failure in this area wouldn't threaten his salvation eternally. And I think Emma's probably in that same boat, if I can speculate a little bit.
I think that there is lots of mercy for Emma, and that she will do just fine.
Yeah, if she had to suffer, I think she suffered more than enough already, you know.
I agree.
So when all this dust settles, to kind of bring this to sort of a conclusion, this may be a provocative question to ask, but, you know, why was plural marriage instituted? If we entertain the idea, at least as a working theory, that it did come from God, something that's difficult, as you've mentioned, for anybody who doesn't believe that Joseph's a prophet, and even for many members who do believe Joseph's a prophet, they have trouble with this. They would say, you know, but why on earth would God do something like this? So I know it's risky to presume to understand the mind of God, but you and I are both doctors, so we're used to playing God a little bit, right?
Yeah, so, yeah, the accusation is there.
That's right. So, you know, what was God up to here, you might say? And you can answer that either for yourself or how you think early members or Joseph would have seen it or both. You know, what do you think's going on when you bottom line all this?
I do talk about the reasons that Joseph Smith gave for the need for plural marriage, and there were three of them that I put together. They are, first, that the Old Testament plural marriage needed to be restored. And it's a restitution of all things. It's Acts 3:21, and that's the easy answer to give to people if they are asking you, why did Joseph Smith do this? Well, just tell them that it needed to be restored and let it go at that, because people know Abraham was a polygamist, and that's the easy answer. But there is two others that Joseph gave that are far more important than that, in my view. And the second one is that there was a need to multiply and replenish the earth because it created more faithful families for noble premortal spirits. And that's discussed in section 132. But the third reason is that all exalted beings in Joseph Smith's teachings must be sealed to an eternal spouse. And to understand this, and this is something that is plainly taught in section 132, but nobody seems to want to discuss it. And it's right there, and this is what I'll talk about. See, what we find is that the Lord tells us that that there is authority that can seal for eternity. And if we go to section 132, we discover that he gives us four examples that help us understand the importance of this authority. In verse 13 of section 132, the Lord says, "Everything that is in the world, whether it be ordained of men, shall be thrown down and shall not remain after men are dead." So he's talking very generally that unless you have the right authority to seal something, it's going to pass away. And then the next, in verse 15, it gets narrowed down. He says, "If a man marry him a wife in the world, and he marry her not by me or by my word, their covenant and marriage are not of force." So in the second example, he's narrowed it from just everything to marriage. And then he makes a sidebar observation. And this is the third and most important reason polygamy must be permitted. In verses 16 and 17, it says, "When they are out of the world," and these are people who are married but not by the authority of God, "they neither marry nor are given in marriage. They remain separately and singly without exaltation in their saved condition to all eternity." And that's the definition of being damned. They are damned because they are separate and singly without exaltation. And then in verse 18, we have a scripture that I think will be quoted to Mormon fundamentalists by Joseph Smith at the last day, because the Lord is narrowing it down another notch. He's saying, if a man marry a wife and make a covenant with her for time and all eternity, if that covenant is not sealed by the Holy Spirit of promise through him whom I have anointed and appointed under this power, then it is not valid, neither of force, when they are out of the world. So the first example was everything that's not by the authority goes away. The second example was marriages that aren't by the authority go away. The third example is marriages that are for time and all eternity, okay, that are not by proper authority go away. In other words, you can have the ceremony right. You can be sincere. You can have a burning bosom. You can have a great tradition. None of that can compensate for the need for valid authority, which I do not believe exists outside of the LDS Church. And then in verse 19, we find the fourth example. And this is where it begins. If a man marries a wife, this is a monogamous couple. Again, an important verse for Mormon fundamentalists. And if they do it by the new and everlasting covenant, by him who is anointed, and they live worthily, then they will become gods. So in the fourth example, we see where the authority and worthiness are combined together to create a situation where this couple, this husband and wife, are able to be together forever. Well, as you can understand, if there is an excess number of worthy women over men, they could not be sealed if monogamy was the only pattern alive. And so through polygamy, these excess women, which are anticipated, are able to be sealed. And if we actually look at verses 61 through 63, they tell us that if any man espouse a virgin, if any man espouse a virgin, if one after she is espoused shall be with another man, she has committed adultery and shall be destroyed. So what it's saying is a woman cannot have more than one husband, but these same verses also say that if a man espouse a virgin, and if he have 10 virgins given unto him, they are given unto him for their exaltation in the eternal world. So we have a man can have more than one wife, and we don't know if virgin is strictly just virgins or if it applies to worthy previously married divorced women. We don't know. But in this instance, we learn that a man can have more than one wife, but a woman can't have more than one husband. So I apologize, Greg, that's the long answer, but this shows why it is permitted. And the short answer to why was it commanded in 1842 and then commanded in 1852 openly to have the commandment withdrawn in 1890 through the manifesto, nobody knows. Nobody has ever told us why God commanded it then, though I think we can rest assured that if it had been only permitted, very few people would have entered into it.
Yeah, it was hard enough even as it was commanded. So what's the most important thing or things that you hope people take away from these books? You know, this has obviously been a labor of love. Like you said, a lot of time, money, effort by you and others have gone into it. What do you hope at the end of the day people who read it come away with?
I think that when all of the evidence gets out there, when the authors aren't just using the evidence like a smorgasbord or a buffet and picking and choosing, but when it all gets out there, I think Joseph does just fine. I think the scary thing about Joseph Smith's polygamy is simply polygamy, not Joseph Smith's behavior.
Right. Yeah, I think that's certainly been my experience. So you've pored over this really intimate aspect of Joseph's life. In conclusion, how has that affected how you view Joseph? You know, at the end of all this, what do you think of Joseph and the religion he founded?
Well, the process, and I think I can speak for Don Bradley as well, the process has made me even more strongly convinced that Joseph was a sincere man, a true prophet, a reluctant polygamist, and I have an even stronger testimony and conviction regarding all of this, and I'm grateful for the experience, even though it's been quite time-consuming.
Yeah, that's certainly been my experience as well. I came out of it much more impressed with Joseph than I had been, which isn't really what I expected to. I expected I'd come out neutral or maybe with him a little diminished, but I was pleasantly surprised at that. So I'm glad you had that experience too. Well, we really appreciate the time you spent with us. Our readers or listeners may not know, but you've just gotten engaged yourself, so congratulations on that.
Well, I'm trying to leave zero gammy, as Don Bradley said, and enter into monogamy, which is as far as I will ever want to go.
That's right. And as I asked you, so at which date do you bring up the fact that you're a plural marriage researcher? Is that first date material, second date material, or?
Yeah, actually, that was kind of a scary thing. Luckily, my fiance had done a little research on her own and was well aware of my previous writings when we were dating. I didn't have to bring it up. She did. And she was good with it. She's very devout.
Yeah, sounds like the right woman then for you. What's next for you? Anything you're looking at next, or are you just going to take a break?
You know, I'm planning to get married. Did I mention that?
Yeah, you did. Yeah,
that's my primary focus right now, and I'm sure that there will be other opportunities, but there won't be any projects like this, I'm sure.
Famous last words. Thanks very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Greg.
Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org, or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Tell your friends about us and help increase the popularity of this podcast by subscribing in iTunes and by writing a review. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Lawrence Green. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the views of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or of FAIR.